I'm looking forward to it very specially for another particular reason, and that is I would very much like your help in the material that I'm wrestling through. I don't suppose any of it's very exceptional, but the problem is I'm working in areas where locally I find very few people who are interested at all or understand what I'm talking about, who give me enough feedback and a sense of corrigibility, as it were, to really push me and stimulate me. So I would really like to, as it were, lay some things before you and get your critical reaction to help me as I'm wrestling on with some of these things. My hunch, having been at Labrie, is that one of the areas that Dr. Schaefer opened, but for various reasons hasn't had the time to follow through, has been his insights into the nature of apologetics. And on leaving Labrie and going to Oxford, I was determined to try and pursue these further, and that's what I'm doing my thesis on at Oxford. Now, I'm not actually giving you any of the stuff that comes in my research, because I haven't integrated that in my whole way of thinking about it at the moment. But what I'd like to give you is some material that I'm working on around the edges that have nothing to do with Oxford, but I'm just working away on my Bible studies and my own personal reading and so on. And the trouble is that in this country, there's so little thinking in apologetics. I've been a Christian nearly 20 years, and I've never heard more than 10 minutes spoken of it in all my years outside Labrie circles. So that, quite frankly, I don't find sufficient stimulation, let alone support, to really know that I'm not heading in directions that are bizarre and eccentric and quite hopeless. So quite genuinely, I'm putting this forward and really would like you to maul it over, if necessary. Or mull it over, definitely. So that it'll be a help to me. So let me say that I'm not coming with any great sense. I've got something to deliver to you. But I want to put something out and really get your critical comeback, and I very much appreciate all that you stand for down here. What I'd like to do is a short series on apologetics, the first one just being introductory. You know, I prepared this actually for a church group in Oxford, but people up there were so clueless that almost nobody gave me any comeback at all. But it had the slight benefit that I've got the outline that I gave them. So I've got a few here. If anyone likes these, you'll at least see where we're going tonight. I'll pass these around. This is roughly the outline of where we're going. But this is very much an introductory talk on where I see the situation in apologetics today, and some of the problems that we'll be looking at. I call it an apology for apologetics. There may not be enough. Just to give some people an idea where we're going. Hopefully not everyone will be lost. As I see it, the basic question we ask is this: how do we make convincing sense of the gospel to our contemporaries? That's the basic question I start with. The two basic assumptions behind my own research are these. Firstly, that we appreciate the sense of pride that Christians have in the gospel. That's my first basic assumption. One sociologist of religion has written recently, when all is said and done, the Christian community really consists of people who keep on telling the story to each other, some of whom climb up on various boxes to tell it to other people. In other words, if you look back over history, one of the basic dynamics in Christianity has been the pride and dynamic of sharing the gospel. From Paul in Romans 1, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, to something down, say, like Charles Wesley's, happy with my latest breath I may but gasp his name, preach him to all and cry in death, behold the Lamb. You sense something of this dynamic right through Christian history, this sense of pride in the gospel, which underlies evangelism and apologetics. That's my first assumption, that we know that. Secondly, though, we not only sense that pride in the gospel, we also sense something of perplexity of sharing this in today's world. In 20th century Europe or America, we're in a world that's, one, post-Christian to some degree, but even more important, pluralistic to a very advanced degree, where we're meeting people with different worldviews, different religions, different perceptions, different presuppositions, as never before, so that we're having a tremendous collision of cultures and at the same time a general talking past each other, as Karl Mannheim took it. People not appreciating the differences that other people's worlds meant, and therefore talking past each other almost like Giacometti statues. How do we relate to each other's differences? That's one of the deepest questions the 20th century has thrown up through pluralization. Hostility is no longer enough. Acceptance is not enough. To treat people seriously, we have to take their truths seriously too, and that means taking the differences seriously, and that means more than either hostility or acceptance. And as soon as you start to think of this, you realize that we're going to respond at any moment of our life to all sorts of positions. And as soon as you respond in word or deed, you're bound to give a word back. And that is, incidentally, all that apologetics mean. The Greek word apologia simply means a word back. And so I'd say, quite apart from the Christian assumptions, apologetics is implicit in the nature of the tremendous, what's being called the permanent pluralistic polylogue, which is 20th century living. In other words, it raises the question, how do we make sense across all these different worldviews and so on? So this, however far we go, however much we may get lost in the process, my basic question is simply the practical one. How do we make convincing sense of the gospel to our contemporaries? And secondly, these two basic assumptions. I assume that we have, firstly, a sense of pride in the gospel itself, and secondly, some sense of perplexity over the challenge of communicating it in a post-Christian and pluralistic age like ours. Now, as soon as you start asking, what's the state of apologetics today, you'll immediately see that if you look around the church as a whole, rather than certain parts of it, there is a widespread unease or ignorance as to apologetics in terms of its nature and effectiveness. And this is what I want to look at basically tonight, to look at the situation we face. It's very striking, particularly if you compare it with past centuries. In the past, apologetics has always held a very honored, if a controversial, place. Simplest way of putting it would be to say that most of the greatest theologians of the church have been at the same time not only theologians, but apologists too, however effective you think they've been. Paul, Origen, Augustine, Aquinas, Calvin. You can come right down through church history, and with only a few exceptions, the greatest theologians of the church have been at the same time in various ways apologists. But not so today. And apart from limited circles, there's a tremendous unease with apologetics, which is most uncharacteristic of the past. And in many ways, it's either in the doldrums, or worse still, very often in the doghouse. My first tutorial at Oxford, I mentioned the word. And my tutor said, never mention apologetics in Oxford, it's a dirty word around here. And that would be very, very typical of the whole English academic theological scene. And many of you come from evangelical positions, say in England or in America. Our view of apologetics, poor though that is in many places, is very untypical of the state of apologetics across the world. My own analysis of the situation would be this, that what you see church-wide is two polar extremes which deny apologetics, or at least devalue it, and in the middle, an all-too-limited middle ground. And I'd like to look at these. The two polar extremes, on the one hand, a conservative tendency, which you might boil down to the simple phrase, don't persuade, proclaim. And on the other hand, a liberal tendency, which you could boil down to the phrase, don't defend, dialogue. Now, I'm not going into these in any accurate, detailed analysis. My interest is really an impressionistic sort of map-making survey so that we can see some of the broad challenges. So don't expect anything detailed. I'm not going to argue through various positions. I just want you to see a general overview as I see it. Do you get the picture then as I see it? Two polar extremes which either devalue or deny altogether apologetics, and in the middle an all too limited ground, although thank God for the value that it does stand for. Let's look first at a conservative tendency, and I just put this in the catchphrase, don't persuade, proclaim. Now, where's the evidence for this? The bulk of the evidence for this, I would suggest, is not written, simply because most people who don't like written arguments are not going to write arguments against them. The real evidence for this would be for you to take samplings, or sort of depth samples, of sermons and people talking about the gospel and how to relate it and so on, and doing it. That is where the bulk of the evidence comes. In other words, at the sort of very popular, incoherent level. And at that level, you get all sorts of expressions such as these. Apologetics ignores the Holy Spirit. Apologetics bypasses the offense of the cross. Apologetics panders to human wisdom. Jesus never answered back at his trial, and we should not give answers either. Or, looking at history rather than the Bible, God blessed Wesley in the 18th century and not Bishop Butler. Wesley proclaimed the gospel, Bishop Butler argued theistic proofs. And there are all sorts of these sort of popular, average laypersons justifications for rejecting apologetics at a rather incoherent level, and that's where the mass of this comes from. That most conservatives have this sort of general thing, don't persuade people, proclaim the gospel. And they deny, in practice, if not in theory, apologetics. But you do see two main arguments at a more theoretical level from the conservative side, which equally militate against apologetics, and let me just mention them. Two recurring arguments and three main sources. The two arguments would be these. One, that apologetics denies or diminishes biblical authority. And two, that apologetics dries up spontaneity and spirituality. And both of those you will see argued quite cogently. Those are the two arguments, the three sources where you get this reflected. Two tend to support the first and two tend to support the second. The evangelicals and the neo-orthodox support the first, and the evangelicals and the charismatics tend to support the second. But let me just mention the sort of thing I mean. Peter Berger, the sociologist of religion, makes the comment, he's not arguing either way here, makes the comment, ages of faith are not marked by dialogue, but by proclamation. That has been picked up by many conservatives to argue from that we should not dialogue, we should not argue, we should not persuade at all. We should merely proclaim, we should merely preach, and that's enough. For example, a very cogent statement of this was Martin Lloyd-Jones some years ago when he wrote, I am not sure that apologetics has not been the chief curse of evangelical Christianity for the last 20 to 30 years. Why? In its attempt to argue for the gospel persuasively, it's undermined the authoritative proclamation of the word of God. So don't persuade, proclaim. There's the foremost evangelical proponent of that, as it were. But you could equally find that in neo-orthodox circles. For example, Karl Barth, however liberal some people would say he is or not, he saw his own system as a massive no to human wisdom, as against the subjectivism and the relativism and so on of 19th century liberalism. He tried to make his neo-orthodox position a massive no to human wisdom, natural revelation, etc., and as against that, to posit the objective word of God. Now, whatever the consequences we see, however much we criticize him, we've got to at least see that his aim was that, whether he succeeded or not. And for this reason, he was very much against apologetics. And while some of his supporters, like J.K.S. Reid, have tried to show that, in fact, you can get a good apologetics from Karl Barth, most people have said it was impossible. For example, Clark Pinnock wrote in one of his articles on Barth, Karl Barth, over at least 5 decades of vigorous theological debate, consistently maintained a stance directly antithetical to the concerns of apologetics. Or in the famous remark of Anthony Flew, the atheist philosopher, who read Karl Barth and said, clearly, belief cannot argue with unbelief, it can only preach to it. From Barth's position, belief cannot argue with unbelief, it can only preach to it. You see there this first argument from the conservative side. Don't persuade, proclaim. Apologetics, in trying to persuade, denies or diminishes biblical authority. The second argument would be that supported by evangelicals sometimes and charismatics sometimes, which says something slightly different, that apologetics dries up either human spontaneity or the spirituality of true evangelism. Again, charismatics give evidence for this almost every time they open their mouths in certain circles. But you can equally see this argued at more coherent levels. There was an article, for instance, in a British magazine in the last year called Springs Need No Pumps, attacking the whole discussion of methodology in evangelism and apologetics. And the general idea was, as soon as you begin to discuss it and debate it and so on, you start tinkering, you get more and more involved, you undermine the spontaneity, the reliance on the Holy Spirit, which is the mainspring of evangelism and apologetics. Church growth, for instance, shows that people win more people to Christ in their first 3 months than at any other period in their Christian lives. In other words, before they've been to the evangelism seminars and the how to do this and the manuals on that, and they've had all the clutter of the how-to, etc., filling their minds. When they're just Christians and have a spontaneous overflow, then they do it. People point to the unhappy debates between apologist supporters, etc., etc., etc. And they make a very powerful argument, for which one can sympathize with to an extent, that it diminishes the sense of spontaneity and it undercuts the sense of reliance on the Holy Spirit himself. So here's the conservative tendency, if not a powerfully argued position. Don't persuade, proclaim. So you end up with no apologetics. Quick comments in passing on that. I would say very quickly, either apologetics must do justice to those misgivings, or it runs the risks of being either ineffective or dangerous. Or to put it another way, they're probably very good comments on what apologetics has become. In fact, I would agree with both those criticisms in terms of what much apologetics has become. But is all that what apologetics should be? That's the question. I don't think so. Okay, there's the conservative tendency, and I'm sure you've seen it all around you in circles from which you've moved or whatever. Let's look quickly at the other side, the liberal tendency, and you can put this in a phrase, don't defend dialogue. Don't defend dialogue. Now, a vast amount of thinking has gone on here, and much of it incredibly coherent and very closely detailed in its argument, and I'm obviously giving a very impressionistic, cavalier overview. But let me just mention certain of the things which I think have contributed to this sense of dialogue, not defense, so apologetics out. I think there are a combination of factors, all of which have undermined the sense of certainty in a whole number of areas. And once the sense of certainty is gone, clearly apologetics is unthinkable, and a new stance has to be developed towards other people. Just mention some of these very quickly. What we've seen in the last 200 years is a declining sense of certainty in various crucial areas. These are all very obvious, but I just want you to begin putting them together in your mind and see what we end up with. First of all, the declining sense of rational certainty. This is centered around the collapse of the theistic proofs and of the more rationalistic arguments for God. Now, in fact, this is very ironic. Theologically speaking, I think the proofs were wrong in the first place. But when they were used, more weight was put on them than should have been put on them, but it was put on them. Now that, philosophically speaking, they've been proved wrong and untenable, ironically, more has gone down with them than should have gone down with them. But the typical estimate in intellectual circles, and regardless of whether it's right or wrong, it doesn't concern me tonight, most intellectuals would think that the sort of Dow Jones index of rational certainty has slumped, to put it mildly. The Financial Times index has slumped. Here, for instance, is one Scottish philosopher who writes, as fairly as he can be, and my point again is not, is he accurate, but what are his impressions? He says, once we're convinced with Hume and Kant and their successors that once and for all the arguments of rational apologetics have been refuted, we're now faced with a choice between agnosticism or atheism and the discovery of some alternative method of justifying belief. And philosophers like this cannot honestly see that it's been done. Now, I'm not saying it's impossible, but in today's intellectual climate, there is no doubt at all that it's much more demanding and, to most people, less immediately convincing. So the simple first point, there has been a declining sense of rational certainty over the last 150 years. Secondly, there's been a declining sense of historical certainty. And you can see here how the whole historical skepticism has undermined the easy way of pointing to the New Testament records or whatever as substantiations, if not proofs, for Christianity. Even in conservative circles, the uncritical acceptance of the Bible, uncritical in the sense of reading it just as taken without any appreciation of the cultural background, even that is now up for grabs. We're aware today that there is the danger of eisegesis. In other words, we read in our 20th century assumptions rather than reading out the first century assumptions that are there. So even at the most extreme conservative level, there's an increasing flexibility of the requirements of hermeneutics and biblical interpretation. How much more at the extreme or radical level, where history's almost disappeared altogether? Well, you listen to some, say, of the theologians in the more extreme liberal circles, and the 20th century has absolutely nothing to say, let alone to hear, from the first century. And to put it mildly, again, regardless of whether it's right or wrong, to put it mildly, the general sense of historical certainty has crumbled drastically. The third thing, which is clearly gone, has been related to the declining cultural certainty. 150 years ago, or 100 years ago, or even less than that, the gospel went hand in hand with the givens of Western civilization. So that when, say, our grandfathers went out to the mission field, it was part of it, without their realizing it, of imperial expansion. They went to stagnant societies with moribund religions. They came as the agents of change, bringing a new freedom in Western lifestyle and liberal policy and so on, without realizing it. So they represented something in those cultures that was dramatically different from today. But today, with the post-colonial reversal, a rejection of Christianity in many places, a resurgence of ancient societies, a critical examination of Western imperialism, the rural masses seeking emancipation, etc., 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 you can see that other religions are on the resurgent increase today. Other religions are claiming to be agents of personal fulfillment and political change and so on. And the Christians no longer have things going their own way as they did 150 years ago. Now, rightly or wrongly, that doesn't matter. The point is you've seen a drastic decline in cultural certainty. Now, put those together. Decline in rational certainty, decline in historical certainty, decline in cultural certainty. These are just typical factors which have really undermined the whole sense of the liberal certainty of proclaiming Christianity. It's no longer an unspoken, given assumption. And what we've seen is a drastic about turn, and this gives rise to this movement, don't defend, or be dogmatic or whatever, dialogue. In other words, we need a different stance in today's world. We can no longer hold to the cultural particularity of the West, or the previous dismissal of other religions. There was far too much triumphalism, far too little listening. Now we've got to be humble, we've got to be receptive. The only stance possible is the stance of total openness and dialogue. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said this, not that he was part of the dialogue movement, but he said this, and it would fit in with what many of the so-called dialogue theologians believe. He said, the attack by Christian apologetics upon the adulthood of the world is in the first place pointless, in the second place ignoble, and in the third place unchristian. And that's been quoted by many people who are into the dialogue movement who say, apologetics is part of the old stance of an imperialistic dogmatism that's absolutely inappropriate today. The new stance is one of receptivity, openness, dialogue. The classic expression of this was in 1967 at the World Council of Churches Uppsala Assembly in Sweden. Theme 10 had the title, The World Must Set the Agenda for the Church. That was based on a paper by Hollenweger from Birmingham University. Now, at the time, that was the brave statement. It wasn't just the church must listen to the world, but the world must actually set the agenda for the church and what's to be done by the church, because its whole stance is so much openness, receptivity, humility, dialogue, etc. Now, my point is not to go into the dialogue movement and so on. It's got a lot to teach us in some ways. Obviously, much of it's a gross overstatement. All good evangelism depends on listening. No one would deny listening. But the gross exaggeration of this, the dialogue has become, so that, for example, Peter Berger says there's an awful lot of conversion, but very little conversion to Christianity. And you can see that so many people have got into Marxism or Buddhism or whatever. They have been so open that they've lost their Christian faith altogether. But the important point I want to show you is its effect on apologetics, because there's been a twofold effect. Firstly, the obvious one, that there's now a new external stance of Christians to the outer world, which is the stance of dialogue. But perhaps even more importantly, there's now a sort of internal shift which centers around the fact that apologetics has virtually disappeared in liberal theology. In the old days, the relation of apologetics to dogmatics was kind of like the Foreign Office to the Home Office. The Home Office looked after affairs within the country and the Foreign Office looked after affairs abroad. And in the same way, dogmatics kind of looked after the Christian certainties, as it were, and apologetics convinced others of them or defended the attacks outside. But what you've seen in these liberal circles is that apologetics disappeared altogether. It's got no separate portfolio, as it were. Theology has slid across to take over apologetics, but it's now as much defensive as offensive, and usually it's more accommodating than it is defensive. And if you read modern liberal theology, you've seen this subtle shift across of theology in dogmatic sense becoming apologetic, and yet apologetic in a new sense of defensiveness rather than offense in the old way. For example, the Bampton Lectures at Oxford, which are the crucial annual theological lecture series. The founders' will paid for them to be given by people who had a clear case for the Christian gospel. But if you look at the Bampton Lectures, there's an incredible shift over the last few years. Here's, for instance, one of the new ones. He refers to the founders' explicit apologetic wishes as what he calls a clarion call to do battle for truth and God's truth. Then he says, but my approach will have to be exploratory rather than declamatory, a method which is cautiously reflective rather than bravely apologetic. Such a method and approach have not been adopted arbitrarily. For myself, I confess I can do no other. And again, you can just read liberal theology place after place, and you'll see this tremendous shift, not only externally, but internally, which is an extraordinarily profound shift in terms of the very nature of theology itself. Now put those together and put those out of the wing. The conservative tendency, don't persuade, proclaim. And the liberal tendency, I don't mean everyone goes to this extreme, but it's there, don't defend, dialogue. Now let's come to the middle ground, which, as I suggest to you, if you examine it closely, is all too limited. Now, I imagine most of us who are Christians would think that we're in the middle ground. I certainly am myself, and what I say would be a criticism of my own position as much as anything. But I suggest we need to begin by seeing how limited it is in order to see what it needs to become. So various of these things are very obvious, but some of them need saying simply, and we'll get into more complicated things in the later lectures. Firstly, much contemporary apologetics, in other words, in the middle ground, I mean people who take it seriously, who try to do it at its best, but I'm suggesting are still limited, including myself. Firstly, most apologetics is limited to the open and interested. Limited to the open and interested. You could put it rudely or politely, whichever way you care to. Put it rudely, you might say one would have to be incredibly open and amazingly interested to hang in there with what passes for apologetics in many Christian circles. To put it more politely, one would have to say that the best, most sensitive, intelligent, compassionate apologetics tends to appeal almost exclusively to the open and the interested. In other words, 95% of our effort is being directed at what is probably no more than 5% of the population, which raises the question, what are the other 95% who are not open, who are not interested, and to whom apologetics mostly has nothing to say? For example, most people aren't saying, where's the proof of your faith? Most people are saying, what's the point of your faith? Most people are not interested in answers at all. Most people actually need questions raised to them. And again, you can see the great mass of apologetics is completely disproportionate in the people it's trying to reach. It's speaking to the open and interested, thank goodness it is. But the large proportion of our people are satisfied, unconcerned, indifferent, characterized by a sort of happy, self-sufficient paganism, and such apologetics has nothing to say to them. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong, but it's desperately limited, and as such, needs to be corrected, I think. In many ways, our success is a blind spot. I'm amazed, for instance, at Oxford. I've been at 3 missions at Oxford in my time there, evangelical and other people's missions. What amazes me at Oxford is how little far back they have to go in the public talks. Because they can assume that there are enough people almost on the edge of conversion to keep them going the week. Unlike, say, La Brie, where here or in Waymo, one would have to go through questions that range the whole experience of human life with some people, even to get them talking at all. Whereas you almost assume that people are right on this doorstep, and so you can start there and bring them the last few feet. And yet it is so successful that there's no questioning how to reach the other people who would never darken the doors of a union meeting where the mission is going on. So here's this first thing, which I think is a very real limitation. Apologetics is largely, even at its best, limited to the open and interested. Second one, very closely related, but slightly different. Again, apologetics is largely, of course there are exceptions, you'd probably give me hundreds as soon as we start discussing. Thank God for every exception, but these are generalizations and I think they fit most places. It's largely limited to those who are in need. This is related to the open and interested, but it's an important one to see in a different sense. Need, of course, is very crucial. Need constitutes the seeker, or part of what constitutes the seeker. Need is what starts the search. One doesn't believe in God because of needs, otherwise Freud and Marx and Feuerbach and all sorts of people chuckle over our shoulders. We don't believe in God because of our needs, but we disbelieve in what we believed in before because of our needs, which what we believed in before couldn't handle, and therefore we started searching. So need is incredibly crucial. But in our society, there are great dangers in merely beaming down on particular needs. In cultures which are highly capitalist and commercialistic, for instance, where choice has come in every field so that religion operates like a supermarket, you can see the tendency has been that Christian faith is offered as an option, which is all choice and no chosenness, or all invitation and no demand. And people beaming down on those sort of need get their people become Christians. But you can see how their discipleship is crucially affected afterwards. But that isn't my point tonight. This question of catering to needs only is raised by various people. For instance, this is one of the strongest liberal taunts of evangelicals at the Archbishop's Conference, or what was it called, the Lambeth Conference last year. This is one of the things that the liberals taunted the evangelicals with. Here's one of the public speeches. By sticking to certain patterns and stereotypes of preaching the gospel, we pre-select who will hear. For instance, in effect, we may in our evangelism and apologetics be addressing ourselves only to those who are suffering from a particular sense of individualistic guilt, a particular need for personal dependence, and a particular readiness to turn aside from their lives into a warm and womb-like fellowship which tidies up the raggedness of the real world with a set of authoritative pictures and myths. Do you get what the liberals are saying? Evangelical apologetics and evangelism, by beaming down on these personal, privatized, individualistic needs, which are so open all around Western society, are actually tailoring their gospel in a way that's very dangerous. And I think that fits a lot of sharing of the gospel. But even wider than that, you can say this is a criticism a lot of people made of people who aren't evangelicals, the existential theologians. For instance, read Tillich. Tillich's starting point was a pessimistic view of man, which he got from Freud and existentialism in various places. So that Tillich said this, I quote, "Only those who have experienced the shock of transitoriness, the anxiety in which they're aware of their own finitude, the threat of non-being, only those can understand the notion of God at all." Now you think of that for a minute. Who's going to qualify to understand God if only those people can qualify? And as one critic has put it, "The worse the picture of Tillich's man, the greater the chance to make credible the claims of revelation. For a while it seemed that for Tillich, the necessary counterpoint of the Christian proclamation was an anthropology of desperation." In other words, to these people in that situation, who were there, of course, and to reach them was very, very important. Don't misunderstand me. It wasn't necessarily wrong, although his content may have been. But the point is, he'd so beamed down on that he was only able to meet then and sort of narrowly defined himself out of a job. Some of you who read Christian magazines in the States in the last 5 years, you remember that this, in effect, was the criticism that Clark Pinnock made of Dr. Schaefer and LeBrie. I don't know if you ever read his, I can't remember if it's in Thamelios or his, but this was the strongest criticism he made of LeBrie apologetics, that it catered only to people in despair. Now, in fact, I think it's completely unfair in terms of Dr. Schaefer's apologetics, but Clark Pinnock was right about various people who'd been to LeBrie and could only handle the negative well. Dr. Schaefer's insistence on pushing someone to the logic of their position, etc., which we'll touch later on, left many people with an inability to witness to anyone who wasn't in despair, which in the 60s was marvelous, because people were in despair all over the place, put it rather crudely. But in the 70s, where we have the opposite climate, nostalgia and apathy, etc., with very few people despairing, let alone showing it on their sleeves, it was much harder to use that apologetics. In fact, they'd misunderstood Dr. Schaefer, but that was a good criticism of many people who had been to LeBrie and hadn't understood it. You see the same problem. It was too limited to people in need and therefore ineffective to people who weren't. A third one, a very obvious one, is much apologetics is limited to people of the similar worldview and assumptions that we have. Just a simple illustration here, because this is rather an obvious point. I'll never forget a time at LeBrie when there was a student from the KICU in Cambridge talking to a fellow from Paris about the resurrection. And for, I think, a whole evening, he'd argued with him about this thing and listening interestingly in the background. And late at night, he got to the point where the Frenchman sat back and says, "Yes, I believe that Jesus rose from the dead." And the Cambridge Christian sat back in his chair with a smile of sort of Bobby Fischer when he said, "Checkmate." And the Frenchman sort of looked at him and said, "So what?" The Cambridge Christian was absolutely flummoxed. "So what? If he rose from the dead, he's Lord and God and Christianity." The Frenchman said, "What?" And then started to show him that on his assumptions as an existentialist, it meant something completely different. In other words, this Christian had had a style of apologetics which was superb, granted certain assumptions that were common to a particular worldview in a certain country, close to the Christian ones, etc. But to anyone outside that, it didn't make any particular sense at all, and he was completely ineffective. Again, it wasn't wrong if you had the right person, but to many people it was far too limited to be of general use. Fourth limitation. Much apologetics, and this one comes close to the bone, often with some of the best of ours and the best of the American stuff, which is the best in the world, it is limited to the rational, literary, abstract thinkers. And I think that's dangerous. What's the average man's image of apologetics? You go to the church and say, what's the first thing you think of when you think of apologetics? Huh? Most won't have thought of it at all. But when you get people responding at all, they'll put down things like the theistic proofs of Aquinas, or Bishop Butler, or William Paley's argument from Watch Design, or something along the lines of sort of 1,001 reasons why you can know that Jesus rose from the dead, or whatever. Ranging up to incredibly complicated arguments like, say, Norman Geisler's cosmological argument in modern form. To put it mildly, very detailed, highly involved, extraordinarily complex, very demanding to those who are engaged in it, and it's exhausting to others, and it's beyond most. Now, I've no doubt it does convince many at its best, and it convinces others even when it's not at its best. But having said that, we've got to realize its limitation. It only appeals to a certain type of thinker able to handle that sort of apologetics, and most people aren't there at all. Someone has described it as the clash between the concreters and the abstractors. In other words, the concreters are those who think concretely rather than abstractly, visually rather than theoretically, very personal terms rather than impersonal terms, using Anglo-Saxon words rather than Latin words, in a sort of gutsy way rather than a cerebral way. And most apologetics only appeals to the second group and not to the first. And it's a very crucial limitation in reaching people today who do not think, for reasons such as television, in that sort of style naturally. For instance, here's one critic. Apologetics has recently, and I think for a long time, flattered the abstractors into thinking that they were by that fact more mature, and has made the concreters feel childish or primitive, and it has left the large middle group, with now one, now another way, just bemused. Well, here's another critic, rather perceptively, says, the codes we're using have the effect of fitting the faith to the literate classes, who are not nicer, more loving, or even more intelligent, just more lettered and usually more leisured. Well, here's perhaps the sharpest comment. Modern apologetics appeals mainly to the more complicated heirs of Christian culture and education. But we must remember that Sartre, Du Beauvoir, Jaspers, Camus, and the president of the Humanist Association are not typical human beings. Yet much apologetics takes them not as exceptional, but as standard. Now, of course, the point is not that we shouldn't reach them. Of course we must, and thank goodness for everything that touches people at their level. But we must equally see that apologetics, in becoming over-concentrated on them alone, has left, in fact, most modern people. The irony is, of course, that those most congenial to that type of apologetics are at the same time those most unreceptive. They're more congenial because they share the mode of consciousness, which is literary, abstract, rational, etc., but they're equally more resistant because that's the style of consciousness which has been more secularized in our culture than any other today. A fifth limitation, and this one again I think is a very important one. Most apologetics, often that it's even at its almost best, is limited to Christian circles. Now this one of all of them is surely ludicrous. The largest proportion of apologetics gets no further than Christian classrooms. Now, as I say, we don't have very much in England at all, so who am I as an Englishman to say this? But in America, where all the best thinking is, most of it stays within the seminaries. I was at one leading American seminary where the present professor of apologetics said to me that his predecessor, who was an extremely illustrious gentleman who should be nameless, he said to me, you know, he never taught people how to do apologetics, he taught them how to teach it. And you can see massive systems of theoretical apologetics taught faithfully and passionately over decades, but much of it quarantined within Christian circles. Compare that, say, with someone like Dr. Schaefer or C.S. Lewis, who either spoke or wrote for just ordinary people where they were. And you see the tragedy of this limitation of apologetics. Massive reputations built up, profound discussions being waged backwards and forwards, but the great bulk of it limited to Christian circles. Now, as I see it, these are absolutely crucial limitations, which means that apologetics is not doing its job of making convincing sense of the gospel to people wherever they are, on their particular level, or whatever they are, particularly people who have no sense of need, who are not open, not interested, or whatever. One could detail a lot of other criticisms. For instance, where apologetics is taken seriously, it often lacks sense, sometimes it lacks love. And the debates among the supporters are tragic in the extreme in terms of the bitterness and the partisanship that they create. A lot of other criticisms we could make, but I don't want to get sort of personal into some of these things. One could detail a lot of other criticisms. For instance, where apologetics is taken seriously, it often lacks sense. Sometimes it lacks love. And the debates among the supporters are tragic in the extreme in terms of the bitterness and the partisanship that they create. A lot of other criticisms we can make, but I don't want to get sort of personal into some of these things. Where apologetics isn't taken seriously, you can see it just falls into neglect. It's hardly a subject in its own right in England. There hasn't been a major book on apologetics in Britain since 1947, an Alan Richardson's book. It's not even covered as a theological concept in the great Kittel's Theological Word Book in the New Testament, etc. You can see, while in some places it may be crucially limited, in others it's completely ignored, and so on. Now, I think this should give us great cause for concern if we are really seeking to make sense of the gospel to whoever we meet, and not just certain people with certain style of argument. Interesting to me to notice the perplexity of certain non-Christians at this disappearance of old-fashioned apologetics. Here's Russell, not long before he died. He said, "In our day, only a few fundamentalists and a few learned Catholics maintain the old respectable intellectual traditions. All the other religious apologists have given up and are engaged in blunting the edge of logic and appealing to the heart instead of the head, and maintaining that our feelings can demonstrate the falsity of a conclusion to which our reason has been driven." And if you read on in the passage, you can almost sort of feel Bertrand Russell disappointed, if not puzzled, and sort of spoiling for a fight and finding that no one's around these days to sort of really defend the gospel in the old ways. Well, here's Ninian Smart from the University of Lancaster. He said a colleague came to him and said, "My wife's an atheist, but she wants to be an Anglican as well. Is there anything she can read?" And Ninian Smart replied, "My dear fellow, we've got plenty of books showing how that little trick can be done." And then he says, "But I reflected sadly to myself, it was very difficult to know of a book that could really teach someone how to be a theist too." And you can really see in intellectual circles this sense of puzzlement at the disappearance of apologetics. But enough of that. What are the two basic, well, what are the basic reasons for this? Now, I'm sure we'd all give our own analysis of these. And I should say, incidentally, that apologetics being in the doghouse is not something that's unique. It's happened in the past at many particular periods. You look back at the late 19th century, B.B. Warfield was lamenting the demise of apologetics. Early 20th century, Adolf von Harnack was saying that the study of apologetics is in the most deplorable state. After World War II, Alan Richardson's saying the same. But the tragedy at the moment is that the challenge is so much greater on the one hand, with this tremendous pluralization taking place. And on the other hand, the tragedy is that in fields like communication, the whole question of how to communicate between people of different worldviews is pressing ahead furiously, while apologetics, which should have been into that business all along, is sort of bickering about its own particular internal squabbles. In other words, the tragedy has happened before in certain ways, but I think it's particularly sad at the moment because of this double thing of the extraordinary challenge we're facing and the extraordinary new opportunities of studies in various areas which could be a help to us. Now, if you were to ask what, if I would ask you what your basic explanation of the problem is, I don't know what sort of questions, answers you give. For myself, in my own musing on it, I think there are two basic reasons why the things largely got off course. The first, remember, none of this applies to everybody. I need to stress that. It sounds too sweeping otherwise. The first reason, I think, is that modern apologetics has tended to come adrift, put it no stronger, from its biblical moorings. I want to take that up tomorrow in terms of what is a biblical basis for the essence of apologetics. The second reason is, and I want to deal with that just in a few minutes, finishing tonight, is that modern apologetics has failed to come to terms practically with the nature of pluralism today. Just a few words about the second. I don't need to paint it in very strongly because you can do your own thinking here. Think of this terrific increase of pluralized options, hobbies, lifestyles, worldviews, religions, on every hand, and so many of these bringing little subcultures with them, little worlds with them. So our world today is honeycombed by pluralized options and areas in which people can live in their own little worlds. And unless we communicate with them in the light of the way their worlds are molding their perceptions, they will not actually hear what we're saying. But you can see that this is what's created the crisis of communication, which has spurred off a tremendous new study. But it hasn't been answered in terms of an apologetic understanding. And this is why I think from the outside it looks so obvious that apologetics is so limited. It's one dimensional. It reaches this group but not that, this need not that, etc., etc. Why? Because it hasn't developed a flexibility of reaching people where they are. In other words, put simply, it hasn't really conquered the whole question of presuppositions and perceptions. Now, what intrigues me is just this, and some of you who've been in the more detailed debates know what I'm talking about here. The best of apologetics, intellectually, has got rather bogged down in a debate between the evidentialists and the presuppositionalists. Best example of that, I imagine you have several copies, because there was a whole number of them were sent to us free a few years ago, Jerusalem and Athens. You got copies of that in the library? The two sides argue backwards and forwards, hammering each other to death. The evidentialists and the presuppositionalists. The evidentialists saying you can argue for the gospel by showing the historical evidences, etc., such as for the resurrection, and then you will prove that Jesus rose from the dead, etc. The presuppositionalists saying no, unless a person's whole presuppositional framework has changed, he will not even be able to perceive the truth, etc., etc., etc. Now, the interesting thing is that this debate, which is just bogged down, if not embittered in many places, mirrors the debate in secular circles some years back. And it's rather tragic that there isn't more of a cross-pollination between the secular discussion and the Christian apologetic discussion. Because while you can take on one side the evidentialists, I'm not going to mention all the names, you know the people I mean, and the presuppositionists, in secular circles you have had exactly the same discussion. Not to do with apologetics, of course, but to do with philosophy of science, social science, hermeneutics, etc. The lineup here has different labels, but it's exactly the same issue. It's the clash between the so-called rationalists, who are close to the evidentialists in apologetics, and the relativists, who are very close to the presuppositionalists. Or it's the clash between the positivists and the historicists. And interestingly, the same clash goes right across the board in philosophy of science, in the social sciences, and yet sadly the Christian debate is taking place in such a vacuum of its own that it's not receiving the benefit of any of the others. But this basic failure to transcend the relation of facts and frames, presuppositions and perceptions, means that most modern apologetics is kind of inflexible in a pluralistic situation. And that, I think, is a very deep reason. Put very simply, in terms of illustration, those of you not interested in the sort of technical things behind it, think of just the Englishman's use of language, or the Anglo-Saxon's use of language. When an American or an Englishman tend to go abroad, what do they tend to do very often if it's their first time abroad and the Frenchman doesn't understand? Either speak slower or speak louder, but usually they go on speaking English. Rather than, say, like the multilingual Swiss or whoever, switching languages depending on which countries. And you can see that because of the English dominance in the world, our strength becomes our weakness when we go abroad. And in the same way, to put very simply, you can see the same thing is true of Christians. Because of the dominance of Christianity in the West and in the West in the world, many Christians are monolingual, sort of monoglot. So that when they're in a pluralistic situation, they're as clueless as talking to someone of another culture as the Englishman is as talking to a Frenchman. And they tend to do roughly the same sort of things. Speak Christian slower, or shout Christian louder, but either way, not speak whatever it is to the Hindu or the humanist or whatever it is that characterizes the language or the culture they're in. And I think this is the contemporary reason, one of the contemporary, the other one I'll deal with tomorrow. But it raises this challenge. If we want to make convincing sense of the gospel to our generation, and if apologetics at its best today, and thank goodness where it is at its best, is in so many of these crucial ways limited, then to transcend these limitations, we're going to have to develop an apologetics which is flexible enough to communicate to anyone at any level of consciousness, any religion or worldview, of any nationality or language or whatever. In other words, the tough thing in modern apologetics will be to develop a persuasive, cross-contextual communication. Now, interestingly, I think this is what the best apologetics always was in the past and is in the scriptures. It's what the modern situation calls for, and what some of the best modern theory points towards. And I think we could be on the verge of a new style of apologetics which gathers up the best of the past and transcends these current limitations, and particularly due to some of Dr. Schaefer's ideas, goes forward in a new way. And let me just say a few things in conclusion. The key thing to wrestle with is what contextualization does to people. The way a person's context, situation, affects them. Now, contextualization has two crucial impacts on the Christianity, a positive one and a negative one. Negatively, contextualization is the key to worldliness. Become too much one with our context, we're in the world and of it rather than not of it. And an understanding of contextualization is the key to escaping worldliness. That's what I was trying to talk about last time. But you see the flip side of that. Contextualization has a positive side too. It's the key not only to escaping worldliness, it's the key to achieving communication. In other words, the negative aspect of contextualization leads to a study of worldliness. The positive aspect leads to a study of apologetics and mission. Because only by taking account of what a person's context does in the total sense of that word, as we'll go on to see, can one really communicate to them where they are and persuade them of a different position. That, I think, is exactly what the Bible does all along. For instance, if you put the worldliness question in biblical terms, it's how to be in the world but not of the world. If you put the apologetics communication question in biblical terms, it's how to be, as Paul puts it, all things to all men, and yet to win them to Christ. And there you have this cross-contextual communication, which is persuasive. All things to all men, and yet to win them to Christ. Or, to put it in the words of the early church, how to spoil the Egyptians, but not set up a golden calf. To go over to pagan philosophies, pagan religions, and find bridgeheads which you can really use under God to make sense, and yet not bring back alien presuppositions which, bringing them up into Christian truth, set up the golden calf. Do you see the same problem again? Or in terms of the later Christians who said the problem is how to adapt, which requires ingenuity, but not adopt, which requires a counterbalancing integrity. Or to put it very simply, the question comes down to the fact, how can we be close enough to communicate to real people? And yet at the same time be clear enough to be saying something to them. And these are the sort of questions which underlie this demand of our age, a cross-contextual, persuasive communication, which I think is at the heart of apologetics. And my hunch is that this is the way Dr. Schaefer has pointed forward in terms of direction. This is actually the skill which the best apologists, I've just quoted Paul, have always had, although it's largely been lost. This is the challenge our situation requires, and it's up to our generation to figure out a style which does this, first with coherence theoretically, and then second with persuasiveness practically. That is what I'm interested in. So we're back to our question, how do we make convincing sense to our generation with all these different worldviews? Do we say nothing? That's uncharacteristic of us, if not unchristian. Do we say something that's meaningful only to us, because we're only speaking to each other? Well, that doesn't help. Do we just say it again and say it much louder? That doesn't really get over, and yet that's what much of evangelism is. Do we say it in their language and express something different from what we really mean, so we betray Christian truth? That's what much dialogue has done, and that doesn't help either. Or do we say something that is clear and convincing and Christian, and if so, how? That's what we're after. Let me leave it there tonight.